many of you. I feel like it was half this big last year. It's fun. Very excited about that. Another thing I am excited about that I want to tell you guys about, and maybe your small group leaders mentioned it, do you know that we now have an Insights website? Did you know this?
No.
You're nodding. Some of you are. If you open your, yep, Jill's doing it. If you open your book up, your binder up, right under the Insights word is our website. It's insightsbiblestudy.com or .org, doesn't matter, we own both. And this is what it looks like. I just wanted to preview it for you so you can get excited about it like I am. This is what it looks like when you go, oh, and let me say too, Elspeth has all done right. All of this. Like, I can't even tell you, but I'm so impressed with this. So here's the front page. You can see that it explains all about Insights so that somebody who doesn't even live in Michigan, United States, anything, could do an Insights group based on stuff on this website. There's, if you click on the home study, what does it say, home study guides link thingy on the side, what's that called, tab button. What that means, home study guides is our fancy website name for homework. Homework didn't look good on a button. So all the homework will be on the website for people if they need it. So like if you were to go down and click on that week one of the Gospel of John, it just pops up like that. Your regular old homework. It's pretty cool. The teaching video button. You guys have been asking, Insights as a whole, everybody every year, how can we get a hold of the videos or the teaching if we missed a week? It's going to be on the website now. And Elspeth is so amazing. Look, she even has Mercy from last week already up there. So it'll be up probably within a week, right?
Yeah. Hopefully it'll be up before the weekend, but
if
that's...
your life isn't too crazy that week.
Yeah.
She's managing it. So all you do is click right on that, and the video pops up. You can watch the teaching.
The audio version you can download to any MP3 player.
Oh, see? How cool is she?
Wow.
So impressed. And this next button, this Bible study aids, this is actually my favorite part of the whole website because the video is not my favorite part because who likes watching themselves? Not me. But the Bible study aid is really, really cool because Elspeth has put together a whole bunch of links to websites that are commentaries and what's on there? There's just every kind of Bible study website. You click on there and it takes you to this whole new world of studying some part of the Bible, which is really helpful. I think this is going to be a great website for people, not even Insights related, just a Bible study website. She's just got, you can punch in whatever verse you want, and the Strong's Concordance will come up in that box there. Just really cool. So make use of this, ladies. There's even a little contact thing on there, too, so you can ask any questions at any time. Super helpful. Elspeth, you rock. Thank you very much. So that is our website. Just wanted you to see it because I know if you didn't see it, you wouldn't believe me on how fabulous it is. So make sure you use that. All right, as we get into John today, let me ask you a question. This is my opening question. If your house were burning down, what would you grab? What would you grab? Haven't you thought about that? Okay, your kids and pets are all out. Your husband, well, yeah, he's out too.
Grab.
Photo albums. Photo albums, yep. Cell phone, that's what ladies this morning were saying too.
Anything?
Your purse. That's a good one. Let me show you what I would grab. I would grab, and my kids and husband know this, I have instructed them, if there's a fire in our house, they have to grab these. They know where they are. These are my recipe books. I have spent 22 years of marriage putting these together. It's just like anything I've ever eaten anywhere out of a magazine or someone's house. I copy it down. I put it in here. Everything's in here. This one is all desserts. This one is everything else. That should tell you something about me. But these books are really, really important to me. They're kind of the heart and soul of my family, honestly. They're the heart and soul of our holidays, of our evenings together, of traditions, of special things. They are what I would save if there was a fire in my house. For scholars, a lot of Bible scholars, the book of John is what they would save. If they had to pick one thing they would save out of the Bible, what would it be? It'd be the book of John. It's that essential to the Bible. I mean, what do we tell new Christians to read? The second they come to Christ, we're like, Gospel of John, get into the Gospel of John. it's really, really important to our Christianity and who Christ is. And not only the whole book of John, but specifically chapter 1 is one of what scholars would say four chapters in the Bible. John chapter 1 is one of those chapters that tells us who Christ is. It's an essential Christology, that's a fancy word, for it tells us who Christ is. It's a really important chapter. So I'm excited that we get to dig into this tonight. I feel like kind of special that I get to do this John chapter 1 stuff. And some of you are probably thinking, but wait a second, Dee Dee always does an introduction that first week. You know, she gives us kind of an overview of the whole book. I don't want to start digging right in. That doesn't feel right to me. But I'll let you know that as I was studying this John 1, I thought, it really is an introduction to the whole book. Did you feel that way as you were doing your homework? It's like, it's giving you a feel for the whole entire book. So, thanks to John and the way he wrote, we get to do an introduction and study chapter 1 all in 1 week tonight. So, that's what we're going to do. First things first, though, really quick, who was John the man? If we're going to study his book, we got to know who he was. And your homework covered that pretty well, but we'll look at it a little bit, too. He was one of Jesus' disciples, right? One of the 12. But he was also really one of Jesus's closest, tightest disciples. He was what we'd probably call today one of Jesus' BFFs, right? Because there's Peter, James, and John. Those three. If the 12 disciples were tight with Jesus, those three were even tighter. They spent lots of time with him. And does anybody know what other books John wrote? He wrote four other books in the Bible.
First John, Second John.
If you didn't come up with First, Second, Third John, I was going to be like, yeah. And what else? What's the fourth?
Revelation,
exactly. It occurred to me, too, as I'm studying about John, that God had really taken time with him. Jesus had taken time with him to prepare him for one special ministry, one particular passion in his life that he had. And that was the job of showing people, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that Jesus is God. That was John's main passion and main purpose in life. Kind of like when we studied Romans last year. You remember that Paul had one main passion and purpose in life? Anybody remember what that was? Gentiles. I heard it over here. To preach the gospel to the Gentiles. That was Paul's thing. He talked about it all the time. John's thing is that he wants to make sure that people know that Jesus is God. And I think that he was uniquely prepared for that job. I mean, think about it. This is a picture of the Transfiguration that I found online. Not a very good one, but whatever. Think about how John had been prepared to show people that Jesus is God. He was there when Jesus was on the mountain, and his face became light, and his clothing... Hello, I'm getting excited. His clothing became light, and Elijah and Moses showed up, and God was speaking audibly from heaven. I mean, if you were John and had stood there and watched the glory of God shining out of Jesus, don't you think you'd be pretty convinced that he was God? There'd be little doubt in your mind. You'd be pretty passionate about it. And then think about the book of Revelation that he wrote. He wrote that after he'd had that experience with an angel who showed him what the future reign of Christ was going to look like. I mean, John had spent time in heaven seeing Jesus on his throne. If there was ever anything that was going to make you passionate about the fact that Jesus is God, it would be that. So this was John's heart. This was his heartbeat. This is what he wants us to know, that Jesus is God. So it's not surprising, then, that the purpose of the Gospel of John is for John to show us that Jesus is God, right? And of the four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, the first three, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, are called, well, scholars call them the Synoptic Gospels. Because those three Gospels all kind of share the same stories and the same things that Jesus did while he was here on earth so that they could show his humanity and who he was as a person. John takes the life of Christ and kind of spins it a little bit, and he shows different things that Jesus did and talks about some different miracles, and he focuses in on the things that really show Jesus' deity, show that he was God. So that's how John wrote the book, too. So the purpose of the book of John, to show us that Jesus is God. And we're going to talk a little bit later about the fact that there's a reason that John wants us to know that Jesus is God, but we'll get to that. So honestly, I could probably send you all home right now just with that main thing. You're laughing because you know I'm not going to send you home right now. But we're going to dig in a little bit and see, okay, how is it? How is it that John shows us that Jesus is God this morning? So here's how we're going to do it. Did I say this morning? Sorry, it's because I talked this morning and it was coming out of my mouth tonight. So here's how we're going to do it. We're going to break down our talk tonight. John shows us that Jesus is God. How? By building anticipation in verses 1 through 14 of chapter 1. By bringing it home in verses 15 through 18. And by backing up his point in 19 and then really for the rest of the book. So first, John shows us that Jesus is God. How? By building anticipation. He's building anticipation here in these first 14 verses to really draw his readers in and make us want to know who the Word is. I love the drama John uses here in the beginning. Did you feel that when you were reading it, those first few verses? Mm-hmm. They felt so dramaful to me. None of the other Gospels are that exciting. I mean, let me show you. Here's the beginning of Matthew. This is a record of the ancestors of Jesus the Messiah, a descendant of David and of Abraham. Really, Matthew? I'm not winning any kind of prizes with that one. And here's Mark. This is the good news about Jesus the Messiah, the Son of God. Yeah, all right. Still not grabbing me. Luke. Many people have set out to write accounts about the events that have been fulfilled among us. They use the eyewitness reports circulating among us from the early disciples. A little better, but you know, it's not doing it for me. But then John, in the beginning, the Word already existed. The Word was with God, and the Word was God. He existed in the beginning with God. Can't you just see these words, like, rolling on the screen with the Star Wars stars? James Earl Jones or somebody speaking them? I just love the drama. I feel like there's a reason for it, though. He's got this whole drama thing going to build anticipation. In fact, this is how my brain works. This is how I picture John, because I'm picturing some guy with a feathery quill pen writing. That's what I think. Right. I don't know if Jesus wore clothes like that either. I'm going to say no, but that's how I picture him. Why do you think, though, that John started his book this way? To understand why he has this dramatic, poetic thing about the Word. What is that? We have to understand a little bit about the mind and philosophy of a first century Greek person. I mean, when we read those first few verses that I just read, we kind of go, what? What does that mean? But if you put yourself in the mindset of a first century person tonight, okay, pretend that you had olives and figs for your snack in your class just now. I had chicken shawarma, by the way, last week at a restaurant in Detroit. Good stuff, I'm just saying, if you get the chance. If that's how they eat in the Middle East, I'm in. But anyway, I digress, I know. So the people in the first century would have been reading these first verses in the book of John, and this is a Greek New Testament. I just wanted to show you what it would have looked like when they were reading these verses. This is my husband's, not my Greek New Testament. I could not read a word in here, and neither can my husband, honestly, but he had this in seminary. So here it is. In the beginning was the Word. And I'm showing you this because that Greek word right there, is the word logos. It looks like that. Isn't it pretty? I love Greek words. They're so pretty. So make sure you copy that perfectly into your notes. kidding. John uses this word logos 36 times in the book. And he does that for a reason. He knows that his readers will recognize and understand this word. And here's why. Here's why they'll recognize and understand it. Okay, thinking caps, ladies, this is deep stuff we're going into here. In 500 BC, that's even way before John's time. This book was written in, what, 50 AD or something like that? So this was way before John's time. But there was a philosopher named Heraclitus, and I'm sure I just botched that name, but he's dead. He doesn't, so he won't care. But he was one of the first ones to introduce this idea of logos into culture. Okay? He used the term to represent the fact that there is a principle of order and knowledge that overrides everything. Kind of like the meaning and purpose behind things. And then Aristotle, in like the 300-ish BC, used the word logos to represent the final argument in a field of study. Okay, just starting to click a little bit. Kind of like getting in the last word in a discussion or something that gets to the heart and meaning of a matter. Now, later philosophers then took this word and this term logos even further, and they identified it as the divine animating principle pervading the universe. Let that one sink in. You'll feel very smart if you let us. Thank you. Logos was the final word and meaning of everything. It was the reason that things exist. If we were to put it into modern day terms, we would call it, like, let's go with our Star Wars theme. We would call it the Force, right? The word would be, we'd say the Force. Or I hear people today use the word karma. Does that give you a, kind of an idea of how this phrase, the word, would have hit a first century Greek person? So that was John's thought in his day about this idea. When a first century reader opened the book of John and read about the word, they weren't confused at all. They knew exactly what he was talking about. It was common lingo in their day. John was taking something from the culture of his day and using it to introduce Christ to the people all around him. He was saying that, yes, there's something that gives meaning and order to the society, and then he's, or to society, where did I get that? To the universe, and that he was going to tell them what, or rather who, that something was. Make sense? It's the same kind of thing that Paul did in the book of Acts. Remember when he was talking to the city council in Athens? And Paul's kind of, this is my interpretation, racking his brain thinking, how do I talk to these people about Jesus? How do I do it? And he's standing there and he looks around and there's all of these statues of the different gods of the day that they worshipped. And there was one statue that said, to an unknown god, so in case they were to miss one, you know. So they had the statue and Paul said, hey, people of Athens, this unknown god that you're worshipping, let me tell you who he is. And he started to talk about Jesus. See, Paul used something common to everyone in the city to introduce Jesus to them. That's what John's doing here. He's saying, hey, people, you know this word that we talk about that created everything that exists, that's the purpose and meaning behind everything? Let me tell you who that is. So that's what John's doing here. So with this first century background in your brain, let's look at this opening statements that John's got going on here in the first chapter. You may want to look in your Bible, but I'll have them up here on the screen, but we're really just going to go straight down through the first 18 verses and see what John's doing. Okay, first century brain in your mind. In the beginning, the word, the meaning, the purpose, the order of the universe already existed. This meaning, order, purpose, this word was with God. Wait, what, John? You're telling us that this concept is a spiritual thing? Yeah, and in fact, the word was God. He existed in the beginning with God. Do you see what John just did here in these four statements? He takes this arbitrary philosophical idea of the word and tells us that, yes, there's a purpose and an order to the universe, but that purpose and order is a he. It's a he, and it's not just a he, but it's God. Wow. Okay, so now, as a first century person, you've piqued my interest, John. You got me thinking here. Tell me more about this word. All my life, I thought it was just an idea, and now you're telling me that it's God? Let me hear more about this. Okay, so John goes on. He says, all right, God created everything through him, and nothing was created except through him. The word gave life to everything that was created, and his life brought light to everyone. Okay, John, so this word is the God that created everything. Okay, he goes on. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness can never extinguish it. God sent a man, John the Baptist, to tell about the light so that everyone might believe because of his testimony. John himself was not the light. He was simply a witness to tell about the light. The one who is the true light, who gives light to everyone, was coming into the world. Okay, now by this point, as a first century person, your jaw would be on the floor. You'd be thinking, are you telling me, John, that the Word is God, the God who created the whole earth, and now you're telling me that this God is also light? So what's John wanting his readers to focus on right now? I just said it. What's the one word that John uses a seemingly ridiculous amount of times in this section?
Light,
exactly. He's using, again, a phrase that's really common to the people of his century to explain to them, not only now, he's already told them, the word is God, now he's telling them a little bit about the nature of this God that he's introducing them to. He's telling them that this creator God is light. So let's look at that word light for a second. As a first century Greek person, you would be familiar with this word, light. It's the Greek word phos. And again, isn't it so pretty? Love those words. John uses this word foe 16 times in this book. So again, he's strategically using it. Why? Because he's relating to his readers. It was common in the first century for people to use the ideas of light and darkness as showing the forces of good versus evil. Again, it's very Star Wars. And we still do that somewhat today. But light and darkness, if you were a first century reader, you would know right away. He's talking about good and evil. So he was telling people beyond a shadow of a doubt, because he uses that word seven times here in four verses. He was making sure his readers knew beyond a shadow of a doubt that this God that he was introducing to them was a God of goodness. He was a good God, not a God of darkness and evil. In fact, he makes the point that he's such a good God, he's so much light, that the darkness, the evil, can't even overcome him. And to top it all off, this good God is coming into the world. Now, my husband jogs and has jogged with this group of guys for, years now. They are now training for their fifth marathon, which to me is craziness. But they go jogging, these guys, year-round, 3, 4, 5 days a week at 5 a.m. Mm-hmm. So in the winter, like year-round, if it's 15 degrees below zero, they are out there jogging on the Paint Creek Trail. My husband comes home with his eyelashes, like, frosty, and it's just craziness. But the Paint Creek Trail at 5 a.m. is dark, and it is not lit one bit. They don't have lights on that, which, shouldn't that tell them something? You shouldn't be on the Paint Creek Trail at 5 a.m. I guess that's beside the point. A few days, here, I'm going to show you. This is not the Paint Creek Trail, but dark. It's dark at 5 a.m. And whenever they go out there to jog, there's always one guy that has one of those headlamps. You see those? It's ridiculous. So this one guy will always have his headlamp on. Last week, they were getting ready to jog, and a bunch of other guys showed up to join them. That doesn't usually happen. So they had this huge group. They had to split into two groups. My husband ended up in the group that had no headlamp. So they're jogging, and he told me that it was actually kind of scary and just weird to be out there. He said you could not see anything past your feet. He said you were just going forward, hoping for the best, hoping that no ferocious deer came after you. He said it was really kind of weird and scary. And I know all this because he came home. He usually comes home right as kids and I are getting up, and he tells me his story of jogging for the day, whatever. He helps the kids get off to school, and then he'll go jogging with me on the days that I do my measly little run around the block or whatever. So on this particular day, we went jogging. Well, an hour had passed, and the sun had come up. So we went out of our subdivision and hooked a left on or right onto Hamlin, and we're heading straight into the east where the sun was sitting right on the horizon. It was amazing. It looked something like that on this day. It was bright and light, and it was warm, and it was exhilarating, and we were jogging, and this is when he told me about how dark and scary it had been just a few hours ago, and we were talking about the difference between dark and light and just how much difference there is there, and he said, that would make a great sermon illustration. And I said, it really would, so that's what I'm using. But that's what John's doing. He's talking to them about light and darkness so that they will understand what a great, good, positive God this word was, that he's light and goodness. So can you see how John is brilliantly growing this idea of God through this chapter? He's just building us up. You can sense the anticipation. The word exists. The word is God. This God is good. This God is coming into the world. It's like, what's next, John? Here's how he goes on. He wants to tell us what's next. He came into the very world he created, but the world didn't recognize him. He came to his own people, and even they rejected him. But to all who believed him and accepted him, he gave the right to become children of God. This is shocking, exciting news to the first century mind. They are reborn, not with a physical birth resulting from human passion or plan, but a birth that comes from God. Here's where John has really given us the good news. He says that, yes, there are definitely people who think that all of this is nonsense, that there's no word that's a God that's personal and coming into the world to give us life and stuff. But John says, to those who do believe, they become children of God. And they're reborn and they're given new life. And we're going to learn later in John more about that life. That's a big theme running through the book. So now John has really captured our attention. And just to make sure that we're really understanding and focused in on what he's trying to tell us, the next thing he does is he recaps and summarizes the whole first few verses that he's just done, the whole 14 verses. So he goes back to verse 1, in the beginning the word already existed, and brings us full circle to, so the word became human and made his home among us. He is full of unfailing love and faithfulness, and we have seen his glory, the glory of the Father's one and only Son. So there it is. John's done an amazing job of laying out the fact in only a few verses that the Word exists, he is God, he is good, he is coming into the world, and he will give new life. So what's the next obvious question? And this is why I've said that these first 14 verses were building anticipation. He's left something out in these first 14 verses. What is it? Anybody? Jesus. Exactly. He hasn't told us who the Word is yet. He's built us up to this point and left us kind of going, okay, so the Word became human. Who is the Word, John? Who is it? Here's where we move on to our next section. John shows us that Jesus is God. How? By building anticipation. We're up to verse 14. And now by bringing it home in 15 through 18. And I can see John smiling here as he's continuing writing with that big feathery blue pen. Because he's playing with us. He's stretching things out a little bit in these next few verses. At least that's how I see it. He goes on to say, John testified about him when he shouted to the crowds, "This is the one I was talking about when I said, someone is coming after me who is far greater than I am, for he existed long before me." See, he's still dragging this out. We're like, yeah, okay. John the Baptist, we get it. He was a man, but you're trying to tell us about this God-man who's coming into the world. Get on with it. So he says this, "From his abundance, we have all received one gracious blessing after another, for the law was given through Moses." This is kind of where John pauses a minute and gives a nod to his Jewish audience. He's really been speaking a lot to the Greek audience, but now he's saying, by the way, you Jews, just because you have the law through Moses, that's not how you get this new life. So he goes on to say, whoops, gave away my big point. The law was given through Moses, but God's unfailing love and faithfulness came through, and here it is, Jesus Christ. He finally says it, the name we have been waiting to hear. All John's fancy, dramatic, anticipatory writing is pointing to this one name, Jesus Christ. And then John adds this last statement to make sure that we really understand what he's been saying, that Jesus is in fact God himself. He puts on this little addendum, "No one has ever seen God, but the unique one, who is himself God," there it is near to the Father's heart. He has revealed God to us. So there we have it. John shows us that Jesus is God. Those 18 verses are basically his introduction to the rest of the book. Who is the Word, he asks, and then he says it is Jesus. And then starting in verse 19, really the rest of the book is John beginning a narrative of the life of Jesus and showing us what he already showed us in the first four verses. He's just backing it up. He focuses on, like I said earlier, on miracles and other things that Jesus says and does in his life that point specifically to his deity. So starting next week, we're going to be studying all that stuff and seeing different facets and aspects of Jesus' life that show us that he is God. But I want to jump ahead now to the end of the book really quickly, because it's at the end of the book that John tells us why he goes to all the trouble of writing this book to prove that Jesus is God. Because honestly, just knowing that Jesus is God isn't enough. If John accomplishes in his writing just the fact that he's proved that Jesus is God, he's failed. He shows us that Jesus is God for a reason. And that's so, why? So that we will believe. Look what John says near the end of the book, after he's told us all these stories about Jesus. He says this, and this is from 20:30-31, chapter 20. "The disciples saw Jesus do many other miraculous signs in addition to the ones recorded in this book. But these are written so that you may continue to believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that by believing in him, you will have life by the power of his name." John uses the word believe 86 times in this book. 86 times. The other three Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, combined use it 32 times. So John's got a big point here to make. He wants us to know that Jesus is God, but mostly he wants us to believe it so that it changes our life and what we do and how we act. This word believe is, there's another pretty Greek word. It is not the same belief. I mean, it is belief like we use it today, like, I believe it. You tell me something, and I say, yeah, I believe you. It goes a little farther than that, though. It means to entrust your spiritual well-being to something, to believe something so much that you're willing to entrust your life to it. Here's an example. It's kind of like this. 1 + 1 = 2. Is that true? That's true. Do you believe it? I believe it. In fact, yeah, 1 + 1 = 2. Of course it is. I believe that. Now, I would believe just about any math equation you'd put up here in fact, because what do I know? But honestly, anything you could prove to me, I would be like, okay, yeah, that's true. I believe it. That math is true. I found this on the internet. This is NASA. This is their the math equation that they use. I have to read it off my notes because I don't even know what it is. To figure the amount of thrust something needs to fly through space. So the amount of thrust to get off the ground and get it safely back home again. Is this equation true?
Sure.
I'm going to say, yeah, it's true. Do I believe it? Yeah, I believe it. I believe it's true. But there are, sure, I can buy that. I believe it. But there are astronauts that believe that equation so much that they entrust their entire lives to it. Like, they will get in a rocket ship, and based on their belief of the truth of this equation, they will allow themselves to be hurled into space and back, knowing that because this is true, they will get back safely from outer space. I'm not going to do that. I believe it, but I don't astronaut believe it. It is that astronaut kind of belief that John is talking about here in the book. John says that we know that Jesus is God, but we have to believe that he is God and entrust our spiritual well-being to him. That's when we have real life. We have astronaut belief in Jesus that he's God. So we spent a lot of time today focusing on John and how his writing shows us that Jesus is God. And we've talked about why John wanted us to see that Jesus is God. Let me pose this question to you now that we wrap up, as we wrap up. So what? So what? How does all this apply to us today? Our study of John this year, Insights, is going to be more than just academic. I can promise you that. If it's just academic, we're kind of wasting our time, right? The study of the book of John is going to call us to respond. It's going to call us to, every week, as we're faced with the life of Jesus, we have to ask ourselves, do I truly believe what I'm learning here? Do I believe that Jesus is God? Astronaut believe that Jesus is God. I mean, just the first chapter alone, look what we learned about him. We learned that he's creator, that he's light, so he's goodness. We learned that he's full of unfailing love and, what does it say, and goodness? I forget. Faithfulness, that's it. The question is, do I believe that that God is enough God to handle the problems and everything in my life? So, with this knowledge of God, am I trusting my entire well-being to him? Here's a few questions that I came up with that I want you to be thinking through this year. Actually, this one question in particular. How does truly believing that Jesus is God change the way I live? Here's a list I came up with. If I believe that Jesus is God, how does that change how I treat my husband? If I believe that Jesus is God, how does that change how I trust him, God, with the way my kids turn out? If I believe that Jesus is God, how does that change how I feel about my body? If I believe that Jesus is God, how does that change how I feel when I don't have enough money? If I believe that Jesus is God, how does that change what I do when I have a lot of money? If I believe that Jesus is God, how does that change my interaction with my neighbors? If I believe that Jesus is God, how does that change my attitude when my plans get interrupted? If I believe in Jesus as God, how does that change my plans with my time? I was thinking through these this morning. I was blow drying my hair before I came in this morning to teach, and I was kind of stressing like you always do when you're public speaking, you know, thinking, oh no, what if this is horrible? What if I pass out? You know, blow drying. And I thought, wait a minute, Andrea, Do you believe that Jesus is God? I had to ask myself my own questions. If I really believe that Jesus is God, how does that change how I feel about speaking in public? Because do I really believe he has his hand on everything and he's God and in control of everything? Every part of my day, every part of who I am. So you fill in the blank. If you believe that Jesus is God, how does that change whatever's going on in your life right now? Because if we truly believe that what John is telling us here, that Jesus is the all-powerful God, the Word, who created the universe, is full of unfailing love and goodness, then that changes everything. So let me pray for us as we get into this book of John this year. So Jesus, we love you. We believe that you are God. We know that we're going to spend this whole year studying how you are God, and how you are light, and how you are life, and all the amazing things that we're going to learn this year. But mostly, God, make our hearts believe. Make it change the way we react to the world around us, just from what we're studying about you. Bless these women in this room, Lord. As they go home this week and they dig into your word, may you touch them. May they feel your presence with them. Lord, I just thank you. Thank you for this opportunity. Thank you for having John write this book, and just give us a great year studying it. In your holy name we pray, Jesus. Amen. Thank you.